All right, maybe we could begin with where and when you were born.
Well, I was born near Kinderley, Saskatchewan, on the 20th November 1921, on a homestead 30 miles south of Kinderley.
Is there a family military background?
No, other than my father's brother was killed at Vimy Ridge. I don't know of any other.
And when did you yourself become involved with the military?
In 1940, I enlisted in the Air Force in Regina, Saskatchewan. I attempted to go into air crew, was turned down and signed up as a wireless electrical mechanic, and went on leave without pay for 6 months. During that time, they offered me a transfer to the radar RDF community. I accepted it, went in the service in April 41, took the ab initio radar course in McGill University, went overseas in September 41.
Let's talk a bit about the course. How many people were on the course?
There were 500 started the course, 150 graduated. The top 26 were given commissions, the rest of us were given the rank of LAC.
What is LAC?
Leading Air Craftsman. I enlisted as an Air Craftsman, second class.
What sort of things did you learn on this course, and what sort of training had you had prior to the course that made you select this, and before you were in the wireless too?
Yes, I had just received a senior matric in Saskatchewan in 1940. And I think probably that was the reason they selected me for the radar course. The people who were on the course had to have at least a senior matric, and many of them were degree people. It made it very attractive. It was they claimed it was on a par with air crew, that you would if you didn't get commissioned off the course, you'd be shipped. You'd make sergeant within a year, and you'd be overseas in 13 weeks if you completed the course.
Uh-huh. And you were overseas?
Very close. For me it was pretty close. The radar school in Clinton, Ontario hadn't opened at that time, so we had to go to Britain to take our RDF.
Uh-huh. Tell me about your crossing.
Well, it was an extremely rough crossing. On the troopship Andes, it was a 28,000-ton shallow draft liner. It was designed for the South American operations. And we were in convoy, went north of Iceland. Heavy, heavy storm, 100-foot seas. 500 Air Force in the group I was in. There were six of us who weren't sick before we were halfway over. Was the British OC troops, and the British OC troops didn't have much concern for what the other ranks got in the way of food or lodging. We were in steerage down below the garbage deck in the stern of the ship, where they'd taken a bunch of Italian prisoners down to Cape of Good Hope before they came to get us. The place was was filthy. I managed to get a clean hammock. Most people didn't, and of 500, two of us were without scabies or crabs when we got to Britain. The rest were all infected. Excuse me, I got a dry throat. Food was abominable. It was, most of it looked like swill. It was called gruel. We got in a bucket. The only meal that I found was worth eating on the whole trip was one night we got bully beef and mustard pickles. I existed by buying canned fruit from the canteen down the bottom of the ship. It was open 3/4 hour a day.
For 3,500 people or so.
Yeah, there were 3,000 Army and 500 of us airmen.
And then crew.
And crew. I had to sit on the deck at night when the ship was blacked out and punch open these tins with my coachman's knife. They issued a knife that they had in World War I that used to dig things out of horses' hooves with a big spike on one end and a big blade. I'd carve open these tins and sit and eat them. And I'd watch the Cape Town Castle, which is right behind us. And one minute she'd be up about 45 degrees above us, and then she'd go down and disappear behind our stern. And I thought, boy, things were heaving around.
You were telling me that one of your duties was to scrub the decks.
Oh, yes. We started in the Air Force being a minority and an Army OC troops, I guess. We won the job of scrubbing the ship. Initially, it was all right. There were lots of us. And it got down to six people. The guy who was getting us, merchant sailor, was coming getting us each morning, and we called him the bosun. And this was a very big ship, and you can imagine from top to bottom decks, it was a lot of work. And he was a real driver. Finally, I think we were about 8 days out, and I'd got smart. I became the hose man. You had to hook a hose onto a hydrant along the rail. And the other fellow said, scrub rooms and mops. And sometimes when the ship was rolling so bad, the intakes would be out of the water, you would get no pressure. And if she was rolling the other way, you'd get lots of it, and it was just like a fire hose. And this morning, we came back to on the swimming pool deck. There was a corner, and a superstructure was built out around the swimming pool, so there was a little corner where it jutted out. And this fellow was giving one of my mates hell for not getting this corner scrubbed up properly. I was hooking up the hose. I had it wrapped around my body. I hold it with this left hand. And I pointed it at him and then turned on the valve, hoping to hell it would come on, and it did. It threw me over the rail. But he took him square on the backside. He was bent over looking in the corner. Knocked him on his face, and I studiously avoided looking at him. I was fighting with the valve, of course. He scrambled around on his hands and knees, and the bolt of water got him in the face, and he had false teeth, and they went down his throat. And then I pretended, at least, that I had been in an accident and shut it off. And from then on, we scrubbed no decks. He never showed up to get us until we got to Liverpool.
And what was your first impression of England?
I think the thing that... Well, first night we had a raid on the city. We didn't get hit, and the ship didn't get hit. And the next day we went to Bournemouth by train. I just couldn't get over the greenness of the country. I didn't realize how really emerald green that little island is. I think that was the main impression I had. We got to Bournemouth, and we were put up in the Hampshire Drill Hall, with bunks in this big wide open space. The first night, the Germans bombed the place, and they dropped a landmine on the hotel where we were to eat. It's called the Royal Bath Hotel. And it knocked us out of our beds. The next morning, we got up, went to breakfast, and the area where we ate was still intact. The bomb had gone on the other end, and the landmine had come down and pranged on the beach. And all they had for breakfast was kidneys, stewed kidneys. I'd never eaten kidneys in my life, and I couldn't touch the things. They smelled like urine to me. And so when we were on parade, and when we were dismissed, I went down to downtown to see what I could find. And I came across some British Home Stores, which they're a department store. I went in, and I smelled coffee. So I followed my nose, went to the back, there was a little coffee bar. And in that stage of the war, they still had donuts with cream and jam in them and things like that. And I went back, gorged myself. And that's where I went every morning. I was in Bournemouth for breakfast.
So what were you doing in Bournemouth? What was happening to you at this time?
Just a holding depot, waiting to send us on to different things. Almost all Canadian Air Force were to Bournemouth. They did change it for a short period, but it was the personnel reception center for the, most of the war. We were then shipped to, at least I was shipped to Cranwell, to the Radar and Communications School to take the RDF course. While I was there, I had an accidental meeting, I think I told you about, with the base commander, who got interested enough to ask me whether I was happy in the service or not. And when I told him I really wanted to be aircrew, he got interested and told me to come and see him the next day, which I did. Sure enough, he listened to me and sent me for medical, which I passed. I'd been ruled as having a colorblind defect in Regina. But the testing was different for there, and using the books instead of the lights, and I passed, and I went on to finish the course, went to Wales on a heavy radar station, and from there I was transferred to was a group of 50 people to Canadians to set up a maintenance unit near London. Maintenance unit was a place where all the pieces of radar that were built in dispersed industry around Britain were assembled, and we put them together, and they were sent to the field or overseas, the Far East or Middle East.
Was there secrecy involved?
It was top secret, yeah, in those days.
What was the security like?
It was quite tight. In the maintenance unit, we had one building, which was ours, and that was kept separate from the rest of the maintenance unit. No one else was allowed in except the radar people. And we worked like beavers. We were in under 11 group. In Battle of Britain, they talk about 11 group because it had most of the fighter stations that were in around London. I think we had four citations from group for our production. They took 50 Canadians in, they trade tested us, failed half of us, sent the others who failed out to the Orkneys and Hebrides and God knows where, and said that we were screen posting and we had to stay there and make this work. And at one point we were 2.5 years ahead of the schedule the RAF set for us. And there I was promoted to corporal, and I was in charge of the heavy radar transmitter section. These were powerful pulse radars that were being put together, and we were shipping, some of them were putting in bulletproof vans for the Middle East, and there were vans that were packed with Kapok around the frames that were supposed to stop a bullet. They were mobile rigs. Others were going out to the Far East, and many were going to stations in Britain. It was a Metropolitan Vickers engineers who had been doing the job before we took over were charging 85 guineas per transmitter to assemble, set it up on frequency, get the power stable, and get it ready to go. And I was myself doing 3 every 2 days, and my staff were doing at least 2 a day, every 2 days, right? And we worked 10-hour days, 6 days a week. At the in October 42, I had the experience I told you. One day I was called in the morning by the adjutant and told I was promoted to sergeant, which was because I was with the RAF. I'd been turned over to the RAF in Bournemouth. The RAF don't give promotion very quickly, but I guess because we were a new unit and there weren't any NCOs, they had to boost us up quicker. In the mid-morning, I called back and told I was going to Officer Commissioning Board in Houston House for the radar officer. And in the afternoon, I was called back and said I was transferred to St. John's Wood to go on aircrew, because I'd had an aircrew interview when I was in Wales. They sent me down to Cardington, and the RAF gave you quite a thorough board, very senior officers, and you come before them and tried to scare the hell out of you, and they decided then there whether you could go Eric or not, and I had been selected. So I went off to St. John's Wood, and from there to Scarborough, Yorkshire, took my initial training there, then to Derby, in Derbyshire, for what was called grading school in Tigermouth, where they decided whether you'd be a pilot or some other aircrew trade.
What did the training consist of?
Oh, they gave you 12 hours of instruction. At 7 hours, they gave you a progress test, and if you were good enough, they let you go solo. And then they gave you the other 5 hours to a bit more advanced. Actually, I went solo at 7 hours. I had quite a hairy experience. I'd lived and breathed the idea of flying all up to this point. I read everything. I was just practically slept it. And I guess now I know what was happening now. When I started flying the Tiger Moth, I was doing it too well, and the instructor was trying to shake me up. So every time I'd come in and make a landing, he would grab the Gosport tube used for communication between cockpits, and he'd roar at me, "My God," he said, "you're trying to wipe the undercard off this thing," etc., etc. I couldn't really figure it out because I knew that my landings weren't anywhere as heavy as some of his. But he kept us up, and then my progress check was coming up on the 7th, and I was the only Canadian there. No one used my name, they just call me Canada. Because you had flashes on your shoulders, I guess. Anyway, I stayed awake all night worrying about this problem. And what I had done, I'd taken off my big old bulky flying boots. The Tiger has a bar, no brakes, a tail skid, no brakes, just a rudder bar. And it, with the big old bulky boots, it was awkward to feel the rudder. I thought I'd have a better feel on the rudder if I put on my sneakers, or plimsolls, they call them. They're a REF has a little running shoe that's got a cord sole, quite thick. And between flights, we've been playing soccer and various games, and I ripped the sole of this thing. Anyway, I went out the next morning, and a officer from the main drum had come down, a fellow who was on a rest cure from Stirling's. And he took me up, and I was so tired, I got sort of a little bit numbed, and I took off, did the exercise. He came back, and we landed. Next thing I knew, he was climbing out of the front cockpit and said, "All right, take it away yourself." And, I really woke up in a hurry then, and as being a good airman, it was a little grass field. I looked over my shoulder and make sure there was no one else coming on approach, and I saw the windsock, took off, and when the Tiger's tail comes up, there's quite a severe swing to the starboard, and you catch it from the rudder. Well, I pressed on the rudder and didn't move. And I suddenly realized my rudder was stuck, and one foot was stuck to it. And what had happened is broken sole had gone underneath the rudder and jammed. And when I saw that, I looked out again. I'm at about 45 degrees. I'm looking through the prop of the ground. I'm 30 degrees out of wind, and I'm heading for the trees. No brakes, no way to stop. And I put my left foot over on the other side, and I yanked, and I tore that sole right off the shoe, kicked the bars loose. And then I'm running out of field, and all I could do was hold it down and hope. When I pulled it off, with just me in it, the airplane was so much lighter, it just took off like an elevator. And I missed the trees by about 10 feet. I came back and landed, and the poor old guy who had checked me out came over, and he said, "My God," he said, "that landing would have done credit to an instructor," but he said, "what the hell happened on the takeoff?" And I reached down and picked up the sole of the boot, showed him. He looked at it and he said, "if you wear those damn things again, I'll kick your ass." That was my first solo.
What time frame are we looking at here? Is this?
That was April 43.
April 43, and
I had gone through the training in Scarborough, and there was a big delay to getting to fields. In Britain, the weather's so bad that flying training's very slow. That's really why they came over to Canada and Rhodesia to do the main training. So I did 4 hours drill, 4 hours PT, and run around the country every day for about 3 months.
Must have been in good shape at the end of that.
Yeah, it was. I told you, they put us through a marathon run, only four of us finished. The others were smart, they just quit.
And after that period, where did you go?
After Derby, I went to the RAF depot in Manchester, where they sent people to Canada for the rest of their training order to Rhodesia. And they hadn't got enough room for us there, so they sent us to Ludlow to dig ditches for an old air marshal, make roads on his property, I found out later. And I had the temerity one day when the senior brass were in, they come in the mess tent, and they always, and the order officer would ask for any complaints. Of course, most people never said anything because it didn't do them any good. But the facilities for washing your kit was so bad, so rotten, two big old tubs, and by the time you got 2,000 men through them, they were just people getting trench mouth and whatnot. So I had a complaint, and I took the senior officer, he was an air marshal, back to the back of the place and showed him this. And the next day I was transferred back to the RCF at Warrington. It didn't want me around, I guess. I came back to Canada, completed my aircrew training, and went back to Britain again in 44.
And while you were, was that at Davidson?
I went to Davidson for elementary on Cornell's, and then to service on Anson's for service flying. Went to Calgary, what was called the Air Graduate Training Scheme. It was a commando course. In Britain, we had so many aircrew stacked up in the line that they had to do something with them, keep them out of mischief. So they were sending them on commando courses, and they were half killing these guys. So they decided that before we went over, they'd give us the treatment so we'd be in better shape, I guess. So I went through that course. A bunch of Army guys, ex-DF veterans, officers, were putting us pigeons through the hoops. And when that was over, I'd been told I was going to be an instructor, and I'd actually sent for my wife, who was in Britain. When it was over, they gave me the option of whether of going to Pierce, Alberta, to the instructor school, or going to Summerside to take the general reconnaissance course for to be trained to fly with the naval convoys. There were a lot of courses involved. It was probably the toughest course in aircrew in those days. But the prestige course was relative navigation. You had to be able to leave a convoy, go out here and do something, a search for submarines or whatever, and join the convoy somewhere else, and it might have changed course two or three times in the process. After that, I dodged a couple of Coastal Command postings, but one was to the Bahamas on Libs, and another out here to Pat Bay on Kansas, because I still wanted to get back to Britain. My wife was still there. And then I got a transfer back to Britain. And I went. I was going to go on bullfighters, anti-shipping strike. In those days, we were getting to the end of the war, and we knew it, and a tour on bullfighters along the Norwegian coast, they were torpedoing coastwise shipping that the Germans had, taking iron ore and God knows what back from Norway. And a tour was 7 operations. Casualty rate was something like 65%, though. As we were still stupid enough to be going in against flagships with a torpedo and a bullfighter, which was a very fast airplane, but you had to get down to 120 knots and go in and drop the fish right on the water. Your only evasive action was this sort of thing, you pitch. And of course, you were a sitting duck for the gunners and the flak towers and these ships, which were the spare workers, they called the flagships. They were supposed to be unsinkable. They were holds full of KPOC and all that kind of stuff. Well, anyway, at that point I was being given a course by the Navy. It's called Naval School. And during that course, the RAF sank the Tirpitz when it was trying to get out. When the Tirpitz was gone, there was no more coastwise shipping, so I got transferred to 6th Bomber Group in Yorkshire, went through heavy conversion on Lancasters, and got transferred to 419 Squadron, only to find that they were finishing off all the crews that had 20 ops or better, and all I got to do were what they call big nickels, the diversionary raids. You flew with a full load of ammunition, and the guns, the gunners had, I think we had a quarter of a million rounds or something, or not a quarter, no, yeah, 250,000 rounds we had, yeah, in the various drums. And we flew without any ECM protection. The notion was that we'd spoof fighters into thinking they'd come and draw them from the bomber stream. We only had one attack, and we escaped him by corkscrewing. We had a maneuver called a corkscrew, which were aircraft flying at night and separate, not in formation. It was a pretty good maneuver. If the gunner saw the fighter, I'd always wanted to be on fighters, but when I got on bombers and discovered that you weren't quite as sitting duck as I thought you were, and also, I guess, the teamwork aspect with a crew is something you value. The corkscrew maneuver is one which the gunner sees the fighter wherever he'll tell you where he is. If he's on your starboard side, he'll warn you it's a corkscrew starboard. The fighter may be coming in a curve of pursuit like this, and he gets you in his sights, and as soon as he starts shooting, and as soon as he's getting close to you, if the gunner sees the trace very close to the aircraft, then he screams starboard go, and you ram the nose straight down, kick it over 60 degrees, and go down like this. Well, he's coming in like this, he can't yaw that way. And if he's close enough, he can't turn with you. So what happens is you just go down like that, and he goes over you like this. Well, this night, I didn't get any warning at all. Just a scream from the mid-upper gunner, starboard go. We went down. He kept saying, down, starboard. It was part of the patter. You had a standard patter. And when the fighter was past you, he should have said, attack broken, resume course, go. He forgot this. He was down starboard. And I finally yelled at him and said, Jesus Christ, let's be gone by now. And we were doing over 400 knots, going straight down, almost straight down. I had to trim the airplane out. It was over speed. Anyway, we came back. And in those days, we were told that if they had at least we were told that they had a infrared sensing AI system. And if he lost you, to fly his pattern again, it would take him 14 minutes to pick you up again, if he got you. I remember thinking, going down that slide, am I going to be in 14 minutes? Fortunately, we were coming back to England, and they had short range. They couldn't stay in the air all that long. It was a jet. It was a 262. German, late in the war, they put the 262, which was a twin jet, something like the Gloucester Meteor.
How many operations did you fly?
Just three of those.
Three of those? Mm-hmm. And what did you think of the Lancaster?
Oh, I thought it was an excellent airplane. I really liked the Lancaster. It's the only touchy thing about Lank is if it's fully loaded, getting it off the runway is, in fact, you have to bounce it off. The Lank carried phenomenal loads. The American Fortress carried about 5,000 pounds, so the Liberator. The Lank was capable of 21,000 pounds, and we were in 6th Group, our bomb loads were the order of 14,000. But I didn't get a chance to hauled any of them, but so I never had the problem of on takeoff with the length that you might have with a heavy load. I saw one crash on the runway on takeoff, and the crew got out, and the thing caught fire, and they were carrying a 4,000-pound cookie. This was the idea. They dropped incendiaries, dropped the delayed action, big, heavy ones to discourage the firefighters as they would go off after the fire got going. The one engine of that length ended up a half a mile away in a field when it blew. I think the only agonizing thing I ever had to do is we were on a conversion and we were dropping practice bombs, and if you had a hang up you couldn't get rid of a bomb, and the bomb hammer had ports at each bomb station, and it had a hook, he'd go manual release them if they didn't go electrically. And of course they were the fuses had been pulled when they're about to try to drop, so you got yourself a live bomb hung up. You had to land gingerly as you could. Of course you tried first to dislodge it by diving and the bomb doors open, stuff like that. This one wouldn't go. So you had to get the crew out and then taxi to the far side of the field, and then you, the pilot, had to open the bomb doors, get a flashlight, and go and check the thing way out there before you called the bomb disposal unit. They sent them out, and I tell you, 4 o'clock in the morning, looking up into that maw of a bomb bay for a hung up bomb, and I'm explosive scared the dickens out of me because there's nothing you can do with it, you know, you can't fight it. That was my only traumatic moment.
What was life like in the RAF for a Canadian?
Well, in ground crew, it was pretty austere. They didn't issue any sheets, they gave you dog hair blankets. The food was lousy. As far as the way they treated you as a person, it was first class. I don't think, certainly my experience was that Canadians were pretty highly regarded by the RAF.
Do you remember what your pay was? And what were you at this time?
Well, when I started as a with the RAF as an LAC, I was getting £4 for a fortnight, same as they were getting. Actually, I was getting 2.25 Canadian at home, and the difference was banked at home. So we were not like the Americans. We didn't have any more money than the RAFers had, so maybe that helped a little. Then I was a corporal. I was getting $2.45 Canadian dollars then. And as a sergeant, I was getting 370. That was flying by this time. I started flying fairly soon after I got to be a sergeant. And then as an officer, I was getting 6.25 a day as a pilot officer. Flying officer, I forget now. A bit more, anyway.
So where were you when the war ended? Still with?
I was up in 6th Bomber Group. We were airborne VE Day and landed, and the ground crews came out and disabled all the airplanes, pulled all the plugs out of the engines, and they were having a hell of a party on the field, burning Hitler and effigy and all this kind of stuff. And a friend of mine, I went down to London. In fact, I've got some pictures taken at night with a Rolleiflex camera. A friend, he and I, we two guys, we'd bought this thing between us. And I have one, the chap, Bern German is his name, I boosted him up a pole, a light standard, and he took a picture of Churchill driving by in a Landau, just below him. I still got the thing. And pictures of Buckingham Palace with the lights first time on. Then I was going to stay in England on occupation squadrons because my wife couldn't come out for a year. And I got that all fixed up. I was about to go on a leave on a 48-hour pass. I got called in and I was told I had a name posting back to Canada. turned out because I was GR trained, I had navigator certificate. Somebody thought that flying over large stretches of Pacific Ocean to bomb Japan would need this kind of training. I don't know why. And because you had a navigator, of course. I don't know what their reasoning was, but anyway, they shipped me home, and I thought it meant the crew and I. And I, when they were all over England, in fact, the navigator was down burying his brother near London. He'd been killed in a OTU accident just after the war. When they came back, I said, "Come on, you guys, we're on a draft for Canada," and they came with me. Nobody checked them or anything. When they got here, they found they didn't have any documents, so the poor guys were 6 months before they got any pay, except advances. In fact, they were still in the service. I got out in September, and they were still in, because the documents weren't here.
What was life like in England during the war?
Well, it really wasn't all that bad, I don't think. The food wasn't great, but you got used to it. You might have three or four kinds of potatoes at a meal, that kind of stuff, and bread sausages. But people were cheerful, they were good to us, the inhabitants. And I guess there was enough happening that was exciting that you never got bored. It was I know a lot of people, when the war ended, I really wasn't one of them, but many of them felt lost. They didn't know what to do with themselves, and they really were sorry the war was over. I wanted to get back here and get on with an education, but for people who didn't have anything like that in mind, it became a way of life. And in fact, for me, I had trouble remembering what it was like back home. It was almost like coming back to a strange country when I came back. I mean, I soon got over that, but I got so used to Britain, it just became the way things were, and I felt quite at home.
Quite different from Saskatchewan.
Oh yeah, yeah, quite different. Oh yeah.
So what did you do? You left the service and?
Yeah, I was. They offered for me to stay in the service because, for some reason, people had been technicians. Or had some trade and were then air crew officers were given the option of staying in the interim force. But I turned that down because I wanted to go to school. Got out in Moncton, I forget, just about the beginning of September, 4th, 5th. Anyway, I was in Winnipeg on the 10th of September where I enrolled in engineering. I had quite a coincidence. A fellow from my hometown, through Opella, Saskatchewan, at the time I joined up, his name was Jim Dean. Jim and I went to the recruiter's desk the same day in 1940 in Regina, and we arrived at the registrar's desk in U of M the same day, same time. He had been a med A during the war, and of course I'd done various things. And he went medicine, I went engineering. I really had to fight about it. I debated whether I should go into medicine, but they'd only take 60 people. They had 620 pre-meds, and they had 720 pre-engineers. And if you made an average better than 60%, you could get in engineering, whereas medicine, the odds were pretty bad. And I had a wife, think about, so I went engineering. He went medicine and he got through, and he's a doctor down in Sarnia now. Anyway, at the end of my university course in fourth year, I ran out of money. My wife had been ill, a good deal, a lot of operations. And the Air Force offered those of us who were pilots and ex-pilots and navigators who were medically fit the opportunity to take a permanent commission if we did that, they'd pay our last year, which I did, and I can tell you it was a lot easier life that year than it had been up to that point. And in 1950, I graduated. Went to the Radar and Communications School at Clinton, Ontario. It was originally a 18-month course, telecom officer's course. But they had no degree people on the course before then, and we were the first group of engineers. So they cut it down to a year for us. Well, they put us through a lot of stuff we didn't need at all. And for myself and one other guy who had a similar background to me, we were taken off the course about 2 months. I guess I was there, well, 8 months on the course. And took over the training of the reserve officer training plan, the university students. We had them in all years, from first to graduate people. And when that summer was finished, I was on staff as an instructor at the school. And then the people in the Air Radio Officer School, which was there as well, and had their flying at Centralia, somehow decided that they needed a telecom officer who was also a pilot. And they pulled some strings, and next thing I knew, I was down there as their maintenance officer. And I got back to flying. We were flying DACs then.
Had you missed flying during those years?
Oh yeah, I did. I still had a bug. But down there, of course, they were flying classroom type things. They had equipped aircraft, take these guys aloft, these would-be radio officers. And you flew a 7-hour trip each time. That was why they didn't have enough pilots to fly them all, and so I was quite happy to do it. From there, I was transferred to Training Command Headquarters in Trenton, where I became the officer in charge of engineering and maintenance on the staff side, and spent 4 years there.
What was your rank?
I was a flight lieutenant. Yeah, I was flight lieutenant when I went back as a pilot officer. In a year, they made me a flying officer. And in 52, I got to be a flight lieutenant. And then I was transferred from there and given the rank of squadron leader, and I took over the electronic test and development section of the old Central Experimental Improving Establishment, which was at Rockcliffe at first, then went to Uplands, where it still is. It's now called AETE or something like that. I think different names.
What were your duties there?
Well, I was involved in development and test of all manner of electronic devices, including ECM equipments for jamming the radar systems. We developed the Primrose Lake Range at Cold Lake, which is where they're flying the cruise missiles now. And that was done for the Arrow Sparrow program, actually. I had, when I went there, the guy ahead of me had, for some reason, he just didn't take hold, and the shop wasn't doing very well. They'd had a review board come through, and they found all the staff playing 500 or something one day instead of working. So I came in, and of course I was keen to get things going, and we became, I think within 6 months, we were the biggest section in the Central Improving Establishment, because headquarters started firing work at us. We evaluated, of course, new pieces of equipment, developed others for special purposes. We developed a system to prove that the mid-canada line was not unjammable, and it was shortly after it was put down.
Hey, tell me about that, how you discovered it was not working.
Well, it had been sold to the government as being unjammable. The Diefenbaker government, like, it was trying to cut expenses. So someone got the idea that maybe we better check into this unjammability of this thing. And it was a major problem, because the you set the levels high enough to detect aircraft, you got ducks and geese and everybody else coming through. So you had the problem of differentiating what was something going through and what wasn't. They also had radio beacons at each of the stations, which of course had a cone of silence, and bush pilots were using that as a place to cross the line because they could go through undetected there. And so we got the project. It took us about 3 days, I think it was. What we did was take some existing ECM equipment capable of receiving the Doppler. We just simply built a phase shift network. We received the signal. We could shift the phase, because that's what happens when a Doppler signal varies with a reflection from an object coming to or from it. We could phase shift it however we wanted and retransmit it back to the base. So you could make it appear as if nothing had happened, or that a great deal had happened, and whatever you like. So we put it in the CF-100, took it up. We had a Doppler test line, which was the original demonstration. It was near Ottawa. It ran down the southeast of Ottawa. And so we tried it on it first and went north up to Knob Lake and demonstrated very quickly that they couldn't detect us. And the line was shut down. And I got one of the stations on the test line as my ground base for myself for other testing. Let's see.
What year are we at now?
58 would be when we did the Cold Lake Range, or completed it. It was done, we had contractors working. I was given the job of supervising and having the authority to accept or reject the systems as they went in. I had this is probably not for publication, but one day on that job I was, we were dropping the Firebee drone targets, a little jet aircraft we flew as a target. We controlled it from the ground. The missiles were fired at it, and it had miss distance indicators on it to show, we didn't try to hit it, see where the missile went relative to the target. And from the ground with the eye lights, we were able to position both objects in space and so forth. And we had a crash boat on Primrose Lake to pick up the drone. We'd drop it in the lake, which usually worked. In fact, it did every time that I was there. And we had a helicopter as well. And this day the helicopter was cruising around, of course the drone dropped in the lake, the helicopter didn't have anything to do, the crash boat did his thing. The next thing I see is this Vertol 44 flying banana coming up above the trees and hanging from the grappling hook of the his great Jesus bull moose. These clowns had gone down and shot this moose and picked him up. and of course, it had come out, I could have been in real trouble. I raised a lot of hell. And as a matter of fact, it had an aftermath. The next day, we let the chopper go pick up the drone. And I was going back to from Primrose in a staff car. Look up ahead, and here's the chopper sitting on the road with the pilot with a kind of a disconsolate look on his face, looking over in the bushes. And I suspect that the strain of pulling that moose out had cracked something. In fact, there was a bolt that had been undercut a bit on the lathe too much when they threaded it, and he dropped the drone into the weeds. One drone, sadly damaged.
And where did you go from there?
Then I went to Air Force headquarters as in the design authority slot for aircraft electronic installations. We had a busy time while I was there. We took the RCAF from the poorest equipped Air Force electronically in the world for its size to probably one of the best. The Rock Level Ice Wagon, which was a North Star equipped to hunt for ice, and NRC were doing a lot of experiments with, had been refused landing permission at LaGuardia in bad weather because it didn't have the appropriate radio aids. And since I'd been flyboy as well as tech officer, it sort of meant a lot more to me, homing around in a clag with nothing to operate on but a VHF radio and an old HF and a radio compass. That's about what we had. So one of the things that would have hampered us, I think, was the fact that the technical people were trying to do everything themselves. They were deciding what the Air Force should have, presenting it to the deputy minister and the Treasury Board, so forth. So I thought the answer was to get the guys who were fighting the war to back it up, say that what they wanted. So I went to the requirements people, and the AVM who was in charge was an old CO of mine from Centralia, good fellow. So I went to him and I said, you know, you should be stating the requirements. I should be telling you what there is that will meet your requirements, and I write up the technical submission, but you should be putting it up to Treasury Board and telling them that we'll lose the war if we don't get this or whatever. And it worked. They formed a directorate in requirements, it was called. Directorate of Ancillary and Telecom Requirements. A group captain named Gillespie was put in charge. And so we made the technical submissions and they presented them. And we got the approvals. And along with fitment by contractors, we started a fitment program with existing resources, technicians and bases doing the work. It turned out very successfully. In fact, the work done by our own technicians had far fewer what we called UCRs, unsatisfactory condition reports, than anything that came out of Canadair or any of the other aircraft contractors. Then I was Rotten Training apparently had scheduled me for a postgraduate course in MIT. Somebody screwed up and they didn't tell me until it was October of the year I should have gone. And when I found out about it and I phoned the Dean of Graduate Studies at MIT, he said, well, the course started in June. And even if you could come though, I've got no space for you. So I was a little disappointed at that. The next year, the service decided to send me to, in fact, the boss of the branch called me in and said, you've been in nuts and bolts too long, you need to get a course in management. And they sent me to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. for a master's course in engineering administration. Like I told you before, it's sort of the engineering equivalent of an MBA. But it's given by an engineering school and it stresses operations research and factory and maintenance management, R&D management, that sort of stuff.
It was supposed to be a 3-year course?
Yeah, that was a 3-year regular, you know, a total of 6 semesters. And I only had 1 year to take it, so I did it in 3. It was a rough go, but I enjoyed myself. My housing was subsidized. No problem with money. All I can do is work. And when I think back on it, there are some very nice things. One of the nicest things, I guess, is a kind of an aside, but there were 5 U.S. Army people, Air Force and Army, on what they call bootstrap. They give them leave without pay to go and take university courses. These guys were pounding their way through, and I got to know them. When we got into the officer search course, there was an instructor who worked, he was a PhD with one of the computer companies, but he was terrible. He just was useless as an instructor. And so I had to go to the library and research like mad to find out what's going on. It's not an officer search is a bit like statistics. Until you get the hang of it, it's all Dutch. Anyway, I started to get some ideas, and I got talking with these other buddies, and one was a telecom officer in the U.S. Army Signal Corps, Jim Joska, and he and I started to see some daylight. And in the bull sessions we had, we had 2 hours one Wednesday afternoon that we didn't have, well, at least I didn't have classes. I had more classes than they did. We would meet him there in this empty classroom and shoot the breeze, the five of us. And pretty soon it became an instructional session, Joska and I doing the instructing, which is, for me, the best way to learn anything. My gosh, in a week, we had the room full of people. We didn't pay much attention to them. We just went ahead and did our thing, and they listened to us. And what I didn't know at the time was that the director of that program was a strange guy, and he insisted on a 30% failure rate, which in a graduate program doesn't make any sense. He failed to get his PhD, as a matter of fact, because of his personal problem. And in fact, he came out the day I was getting my oral comprehensive. He was ahead of me, and he was a sick-looking guy. But when I was getting ready to go to Wright-Patterson, we lived in North Arlington. In fact, I had the house, Admiral Sides, who was the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. I had his home for all the time I was there. Four guys drove up in a car, and one big guy got, I'd seen him before, but it turned out these four were engineers from GE in Baltimore, and they were coming in. They were on the part-time program. You had 5 years to get your degree, and he came up and shook my hand. He said, gosh, he said, I'm sure glad we caught you. Yeah, he said, you remember that Wednesday afternoon session that you guys had in the university? And I said, yeah. He says, well, we came in from Baltimore to attend it. This is in the middle of the day. Can you believe that? He said, we're here to tell you that because of that, we were getting our degrees. He told me there were 500 people who wouldn't be getting their degrees because of that course. And you know, that for me, that was one of the nicest things that ever happened to me. Totally accidental. I mean, he just happened to be around, and we're doing our thing.
Were you relieved when the school was over?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a 90-hour week kind of an operation, and it was nice to have it over with. Then I was transferred in exchange with the U.S. Air Force at Wright-Patterson on the F-111 program. That was a very interesting program. When I went there, it was initially being disputed by Boeing and everybody else who had bid. There was congressional investigations and God knows what going on. Most of the staff weren't there. The SPO director was not an R&D man. He was a fighter pilot from World War II and shouldn't have been there. The program was under budget, over budget, and under and behind schedule. We got a new SPO director in, a guy named Zeke Zeckler, a brigadier, who had run the Atlas program and had turned it around. So he was one of their troubleshooters, I guess. And when he came in, I was allowed access to everything. Up to that time, I'd been barred from things, electronic countermeasures, even though I dealt with the Americans quite extensively in the old CEP days.
Just because you were Canadian?
Because I was a foreign national in an aircraft program, and one of their rules said it couldn't have any access. And really, I was probably his main expert in that area. Anyway, he told me to write the letters and I'd sign them. He did. As a matter of fact, they gave me so much authority, was ridiculous. At one point, they were going to have a photo reconnaissance version of the aircraft. We had $538 million to develop 25 airplanes. And the proposals for the package, which was a pallet that went into the bomb bay of the aircraft, there was nothing new. Everything, there were aircraft already fitted with stuff like the A-5 and everything we were going to put in the F-111. And because everyone was away on these things, and the old sport director was at the bottleneck, all the paper was piling up in his office. I wrote a letter to Washington and said that if we didn't do something about it pretty quick, we're going to be committing a lot of money to a program that was already been done. And someone woke up down there and they canceled the program. Well, when things got sorted out, then General Dynamics heard about this, and their general manager got onto our sport director, and the fur was really flying, I can tell you, for a while. But I got away with it. They finally agreed that it should have been done anyway, and sport director was, not just for that reason, but for probably a number of reasons, was relieved, and a new guy came in.
How did you find serving with the Americans?
Oh, I enjoyed it. I must admit, I had a lot of changes in my attitude toward Americans as a result of that, because in the beginning, just going to university, I thought that we were much more industrious than they were, that our educational system was more stringent, this kind of stuff. Discovered that one so at all. You go to a good school down there, it's tough as it is here. And they are very competitive. Everybody's, like one said to me, that we run like hell to stand still. You know, guys with master's degrees are still going to university in their spare time, this sort of stuff. In the SPO, I found the people were very competent. I had 20 people working for me, and they all had master's degrees. They were all sensible, down-to-earth guys. We had 200 slide rule engineers. What we were doing was taking the operational requirement and translating it into a performance specification for the weapon system. And the slide rule boys were doing the basic engineering development. The thing I found most about them was that as soon as they found out that you were keen and that you're conscientious and that you had some success or demonstrated some, the sky was the limit. They let you go, and I think that's probably why they let Colonel North go so far. They got that happen, Delegation is a great thing, but you have to be able to keep a track on the guy you delegate a little bit.
You were a wing commander by this time?
Yes. Then I was, I got transferred back to Canada just before integration. And I took over the long lines telephone, basically telephone data equipment leasing for the Air Force to begin with, which was air defense was a big part of it. We had some of it, the network was our own. We had an air defense microwave system called ADCOM that ran in a big ring all the way from near Quebec City to Falconbridge and up to the north and down along Ottawa and Montreal on the southern side. So I was managing that along with the budget when I went there was $48 million. They were only spending $31 million, but the man ahead of me was more an accountant. He was an engineer, but he was more an accountant than an engineer. He kept spreadsheets in his office of everything we rented and himself. I'd never make an accountant, I'm afraid. I looked at that and threw up my hands and said, this is not the way I can go. So I told the staff that too, that I wasn't going to be checking all their work. What we were after was finding out why we were doing these things. Why were we spending this money? And part of the reason it went on so long the way it did is because the Americans provide $2 for every buck we spent. It was a good balance of payments thing, in a way. But we went after the reasons why we had certain things and why we were paying for stuff that we weren't using. And in, well, inside of 2 years, we took the expenditures down to $21 million from $31 million. Trans-Canada telephones alone, we owed them when I first went there, I found $1.6 million. They hadn't even collected, they didn't bill us. So that was the first thing I did. I went over to find out why they ended up shuffling their accounting department completely. We paid them the 1.6 and they thought I was a nice guy. So then we proceeded to take it out, buy a number of things, taking advantage of bulk buying. Getting Telpac was coming in the States then. We were able to actually reduce the Americans' bill in Canada by about $4 million a year. And we gained another $5 million south of the border by taking advantage of their rates in the to the Cheyenne Mountain Complex and other places, switching networks. I had the job of overseeing the expansion of the Autobahn network, which is an automatic switch network into Canada from the American system, which had I think 60 some switches in States and about 25 overseas. We put in 9 here from Haney, BC, through Lethbridge, Portage, Lakehead, Sudbury, Ottawa, or Smith Falls, on all the way to Fredericton. And these were, at that time, which was 64, 65, we were probably 10 years ahead of anything that was going in the computerized world and in the civilian life. Anyway, they went in successfully, and I was about to, integration had taken place and unification was on the doorstep, and I discovered that I was blocked in promotion in my trade. There were only 10 colonels. And I was a light colonel. I never got quite used to that. But anyway, senior appointments asked me to if I would consider transferring to aircrew because I was a current flyboy, and the Air Force had very few people in the senior ranks who had graduate degrees, and the Army and Navy had quite a few. So I guess this alarmed them a bit, and they offered those of us, like myself, probably a dozen of us, I guess, for all in the various trades, a chance to go aircrew and be promoted to colonel, you know. So I accepted, and it was all set up, and then 2 weeks later, they came and offered me, or asked me, to go take over the data processing operation for headquarters. We were converting to computer from unit record for the three services. And the chappie had been given the job had a nervous breakdown and he quit. It was a full colonel position. And they said, you go over and do a job there and you get your promotion. Well, I went over and I think we did the job. We made the conversion. We did it without, in fact, we had to train our staff. Things had broken down. There was no training. We had a computer. Bunch of unit record people didn't know how to run it. And we had to train programmers and computer operators a lot. No money. Oh. Well, okay, for it. We did it in-house with programmed instructional techs and the help of 2 Burroughs reps who we had with maintaining the equipment. And I had to cut the staff from 244 down to 165. We did it we only lost one person and he got a job outside the government. And as time went on, I took over the Rockcliffe Data Center as well. Got involved in developing the current computer system, which is one at Tunney's Pasture and a duplicate out at Borden, which handles all the logistics, all of the computing for the services. But they kept the list branch structure intact, so I was stuck. I couldn't be promoted outside my trade, so I didn't get promoted. And after 4 years, they decided, I guess, that I needed some kind of a plum. And so I was being sent to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, to the U.S. Army Signal Corps Research Plate on a secret project. And my late wife was had become ill, and they hadn't found out what was wrong with her. So I asked for deferment on my transfer of a month. The general, who by this time was Army Signal Corps man, he's retired up at Parksville now. He agreed to give me an extension on my transfer of a month if I promised faithfully to go at the end of it. And I couldn't do that. So I resigned from the service. And then I had a notion I would like a job in a university. I don't know why I had this notion in my head at that point. And there was a position at Carleton University. The data processing chief there was gone, and they wanted someone to set up a faculty computer science. So I applied. Meantime, the military couldn't find anyone to take my job, so they had me stay on an 18-month contract. And my job was civilianized. It was made an SX-1, which is equivalent to a brigadier. And I became the DG computer operations for DND and reported to an admiral, a guy named Stevens. So Stevens is telling me, well, you know, you want this job, you developed it, you shouldn't be the one that gets it. But then I got wind of the fact that they weren't going to make the competition an in-house competition. It closed in the government. By this time I'm out. Partly, I think, because I had stepped on the toes of the classification people in the DM's office when I was developing the data center and getting people trained. The Canada Pension people who had the exact same computer were getting grades one level above mine. At the time, the DND didn't have delegated authority from Treasury Board. It's called the Bureau of Classification Review. And the fellow there tried to tell me that they had to be tough in order to get the Treasury Board to give them delegation. I got angry and raised hell. Didn't make myself very popular, and I suspect that I was a black sheep in the scheme there. So when I heard that there wasn't going to be a competition that I could go in, I heard that there was a task force being formed in the Department of Communications to study what Canada should do about communications and computers in the 80s. The communications is the one very big industry in Canada that is almost all Canadian-owned. And of course, computers were not. A very small amount of it was owned here. So I thought it was pretty interesting. I went over and asked the guy in charge. They had a position, and he said, well, yes, he said, here's my problem. He gave me a problem. Give me a plan, he said. Well, you'd solve it. I went back and wrote him a plan. Next day I got a call and said, come on over. And so I joined the computer task force, computer communications task force it was called, run by a chappie named Von Beyer. There were 25 of us, multidiscipline type of organization. At the same time, I had put an application in, meanwhile, that university thing, we're down to two people, and finally they made up their mind to take the other fellow. He worked for Xerox, but he was from he'd been on the faculty at UBC. He had a PhD, and of course I don't. And they said, well, we think that his experience at UBC will make him better relate to the academic environment. That's what they said. They didn't. I think they saw me as a military figure who didn't quite fit, I guess. I'm glad they didn't, no. But anyway, I had applied for the regional director jobs that were being formed in the communications department, five regions across the country. I ended up going for an interview, as I didn't even expect, and won the competition, and I was given the choice of regions, and I picked this one. And here I am. I always decided I'd retire at 60. It was a goal from way back. And that's what I did.
Looking back over your years in the armed forces, do you have anything else to add or anything to say?
Yeah, the only thing I told you the other day in my service career, I'm glad I had a military career, because there's a lot about it that I find satisfactory to me, and a lot of relationships that I made that something you can't get any other way. Just the flying game itself, you know, you get to rely on other people, and they rely on you, and there's a kind of feeling there that doesn't happen elsewhere that I know of. And that was one of my big disappointments when integration came and unification came. I found that in the scramble there were a lot of people who didn't give a damn about the people that worked for them, or when I had to cut the staff and civilianize those data processors. The chief of postings and careers wouldn't hear of having them pensioned off, even though they were eligible for pension. He wanted to remuster them. I did have enough influence that we only remustered people corporal and below 30 years of age. But those people went out with just contributions. The others didn't wear military, they were let go. And for me, that was part of the game. You looked after the people in your outfit, come what may. You, as an officer, it was your responsibility. When that sort of faded, or appeared to be not the way it had been in the past, that let me down a bit. I didn't feel good about that. But I really left not because of that, or even unification, which I didn't believe in. I really left because I couldn't do anything else. My wife was dying, and I couldn't drag her off to the States. I have friends still around the country from the Air Force days. People I value their friendship very much. My wife was married to a naval officer, and he was killed in a car accident. So we have a lot of friends in both those services. And there's still something there, you know. You've got a comradeship or a feeling of belonging or whatever the heck it is. Respect, maybe.